Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Birding Festival gives residents a chance to grab their binoculars and get outside. We welcome Dr. David Swanson to the program now. He's joining us from Vermilion. He's director of research at the Missouri River Institute and a biology professor at the University of South Dakota. Dr. Swanson, welcome to In the Moment.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Let's talk about birds. but first, let's talk about the festival itself. Is this an annual event?
Yeah, every year since this is the seventh one, and it's sometime in May. Usually we have it the first weekend in May. Sometimes schedules conflict, and so we've had it a little bit later in May. But this year it's on the first weekend again. So it starts tomorrow and then runs through Saturday and Sunday.
And the public is invited. And what's the big draw? What do people get to do when they come out?
A lot of it has to do with some speakers that talk about a bunch of topics related to birds, anything from how to identify birds, what birds are likely to be found in the area. And then I'm going to be talking this year about some work that we and others have been doing in marking birds and what that can tell us about the birds' lives. And so you have speakers, and then on Saturday and Sunday, the primary draw is field trips. So we actually go out and get a chance to look at birds, and they're guided by some experts, some regional experts in the area, so they really know what birds are around and where to find them. And so that's kind of the big draw. And we go to Lake Andes Refuge and then below the dam there at Fort Randall and some other areas in that region. And so we come up with a pretty good list, probably in the neighborhood of 130 to 150 different species for the weekend.
What is the bird population like in the state? Is it pretty robust? Are there challenges right now? What are we looking at?
Yeah, there's, I'd say both. I mean, the bird populations in South Dakota are good, so when you go out, you're going to find some birds to look at always. But there are also some challenges, and some of that relates to habitat changes that are going on. And so that's a challenge for some birds. But in general, I think the populations are doing pretty well within the state.
Let's talk about marking birds or tagging them. Or what?
Sure.
How does that work? And walk me through some of the details of the process of doing that and you know, just the how of it.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I've done every year as part of this birding festival is to do a bird banding workshop. And bird banding simply involves attaching a little aluminum leg band to any of the birds that you capture. And this, it's a pretty regulated thing to do because it's controlled by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and so I have permits to do this. And what it does is it allows us to put bands on these birds, and then the hope is that somewhere somebody's going to recover that bird and turn that number. And each band has an individual number on it, so it identifies that particular individual. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bird banding laboratory back in Maryland that keeps the entire database for the U.S., and this has probably been going on since the early 1900s.
Really?
And so it's a huge database, and it tells us a lot about, I mean, it's a needle in a haystack to recover any one of those individual birds that you put a band on.
Right.
But with that many birds that have been banded over that long of a time, you actually do have a pretty decent number of recoveries that allows you to tell something about movement patterns, where they might be moving during migration, if they're migratory birds, and sorts of migratory pathways and wintering grounds and things like that.
I'm fascinated by something that began in the early 1900s. Whose great idea was that? And what do you know about the history of it?
Yeah, it was some government scientists that started that back during that time. And I think it was the Biological Survey or something is what it was called back then. That's kind of morphed into the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service today. And they have a number of people that are involved with maintaining that database, and they make it available to scientists to work from as well. And so all those data are available for asking questions about bird movements and about, to some extent, looking at bird populations with banding, I think, too.
So what are the first numbers from the state of South Dakota or this region? Was that something that was included early on? When did we start looking at birds where we live now?
No, there's been people that have been banding, and to do it, you have to get a permit, as I said. And there are a number of people that have permits in the state now, but probably no more than about a dozen, I would guess. But there have been people that have been banding in the state since probably around the 1930s or 40s, I think. And so there are a number of banding recoveries that we've had. We summarized a lot of those in our Birds of South Dakota book that we know that's been out for about 15 years now.
Right, right. Not many people can or have the license to do the banding. Give us the details of what exactly that looks. How do you looks like? You capture the bird,
yeah.
You band it.
I'll start by talking about how we capture them.
Uh-huh.
And typically what we're interested in for the festival, at least, is to band a lot of the songbirds. And a number of those, May is kind of prime time for migration for those. And so we're interested in catching some of these birds, both that nest in the area and that are moving through during migration. And so to catch them, we set up what are called mist nets. And they're real thin nylon nets that are about 30 feet long. And you string them up between two poles, and you put them up against vegetation in the background. And they're such a thin nylon net that the birds can't see them. And so when they fly into that vegetation, they fly into the net and they get tangled, and then you go out and untangle them, and then you've got them. And then the banding simply involves taking one of those aluminum bands and putting it around their lower leg. And then you record all of the data in terms of the number of the band, and then you also usually make some measurements of the bird and identify what species it is. And then all that data are turned in to the bird banding laboratory back in Maryland, and they keep it in perpetuity.
All right. How do you minimize the stress to the bird and make sure that you're doing this in a responsible way?
Yeah. So typically what we do is we check the nets about every half hour. Actually, at the festival, we kind of sit there and watch them, so when a bird flies in, we get it right away. But typically, when they hit the net, they kind of just fall into a little bit of, because there's some excess kind of bag there, and they get tangled up a little bit in it, but not too bad. And so it's pretty easy to go out and untangle them. So when the weather's decent, like it is now, about checking every half hour is fine. If you're doing it, if it's really hot or really cold out, you have to get them really fast, or either that or just not band under those conditions.
Hmm. So are you finding birds in that net that have already been banded, or is that just an incredibly rare occurrence?
It's an incredibly rare occurrence, but it's happened to me a few times. And so one story I have is I was banding in my backyard, actually, in Vermilion, outside of Vermilion, looking at some migratory birds and that were using my woodlot around my place. And you band these birds, and when we were doing this kind of full bore, we were probably banding something like 5,000 to 10,000 birds a year.
Oh, wow.
And so during that time, we recaptured some of our own birds now and again, so that wasn't too unusual of occurrence. But I went out one day, and I found a little orange-crowned warbler that was already banded, and I said, oh, hey, an orange-crowned warbler that we banded. And then I checked the band number, and it wasn't one of ours. It was another one, and it turned out, because you send that into the bird banding laboratory, and then they get back to you with who actually banded it and where it was from.
Yeah,
it was a warbler that had been banded in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Oh, wow.
And it was banded 36 days before I captured it. So it had moved from Fairbanks to Vermilion in 36 days. And it wasn't done migrating yet, so it was probably going to continue on down to Mexico or Central America to spend the winter.
Wow. So that's an example of what we can learn about the birds from the banding. What else are we looking for? What kind of data are we collecting? What else can we learn from this process?
Yeah, some people do it by if you mark and recapture the birds, you can actually generate some population size estimates. So that involves not just marking at once, but going out of the place and then banding birds and then recapturing them later. And there's some fairly fancy math behind it. But once you go through the calculations, it can give you some estimates of population size. And so that can look at, then over the long term, if you continue that, you can get an idea of trends in population sizes as well.
If you're just tuning in, my guest, Dr. David Swanson from Vermilion, professor of biology at the University of South Dakota. We're talking about the South Dakota Birding Festival coming up in Fort Randall this weekend. And Dr. Swanson, I'm wondering, you know, what do we know about how the bird, songbird, if we're talking about songbirds right now,
how
has the songbird population really changed over the years?
Well, there are a whole bunch of different species that make up the songbirds as a group. And some of those, as you might expect with a lot of species, you see some that are increasing, some that are decreasing, and some that are fairly stable in terms of population sizes. One of the groups that we're most concerned about are some of the grassland birds, because the grasslands, in terms of the native prairie and things like that, especially in a lot of the Midwest, it's been converted to agriculture, and so there's not a lot of those grassland habitats, at least today, compared to what there was historically available for those birds. Not a lot of habitat left. And so that's one of the groups that we're most concerned about in terms of population declines.
Grassland birds, what are, am I going to recognize
I'll give
any?
You some examples. Yeah. So some of the sparrows. Nesting sparrows around here include things like grasshopper sparrows and savanna sparrows and vesper sparrows. So some of those. Also, some birds like dickcissels and bobolinks. Those are some grassland species that are showing some population declines.
So what happens when we lose a species of bird like that? What are we losing?
Well, I think a lot of it is just the overall diversity. And so for us as birders that like to go out and watch these, it gives us a lot of joy in seeing those birds and seeing them doing their thing in their native habitats. And so that's lost. And so I think that's probably one of the primary things. But then there are some ecosystem services that those birds provide too, and a lot of them are insectivores. And so they'll eat a lot of the insect pests. And so they provide a benefit that way, I think, too.
Is there a role in agribusiness in this state to sort of protect or at least acknowledge the presence of, you know, grassland birds and the intersection between their health and agriculture?
Yeah, I think some of the programs like the Conservation Reserve, the CRP program, were kind of designed to provide some habitat for those. And so those, you know, that changes as the farm bills get changed. And so the amount of land enrolled in that is kind of changes over time. But I think that's been a really good program in terms of benefiting grassland birds.
So the South Dakota Birding Festival, a great way to get out and sort of learn some things, kind of interact with birds and professionals who really know the business. What are some of the other ways, Dr. Swanson, that the people can kind of begin, you know, they look out their window, they enjoy looking at birds, and
sure. They
take that next step? What's next?
Yeah, I think there are actually quite a few programs to get plugged into that. And one of them is that Osher Lifelong Learning Institute that has programs in Vermilion and Sioux Falls and Brookings. And off and on, there are some bird programs. Like I'm giving one next week, actually, as part of that in the Vermilion Public Library. And so those are some opportunities. There are also some bird clubs. Sioux Falls has a bird club that's very active and goes out on field trips. And then we have a state bird organization called the South Dakota Ornithologists Union. And we have a couple of meetings per year that have field trips that are associated with that as well. And so there are quite a few actual groups and agencies that are involved, I think, in helping people learn about birds.
A vibrant community and room to grow, though.
Yeah, I think so. Our statewide organization probably has a membership of 300 or a little upwards of that.
Yeah. We've just got about a minute left, and I'm wondering if you could leave us with something that you just love. You know, take off your scientist hat and put on your, I don't know, little kid hat walking around with the birds just for about 30 seconds.
Yeah, sure. One of the great things that I really love is to go out and see everything in migration. And you've got birds that are using wetland habitats and marshland habitat and woodland habitats, and just to see the diversity that goes out. One of the most common comments I get from the general public that hears one of my bird talks is, I had no idea that there were this many types of birds around here. And so you don't really recognize that until you really get into it and start looking at it in more detail.
Oh, that's our time for today, but I had no idea, and I look forward to learning more. Come back and see us again, please, David.